Join me on my hunt as we travel in search of stories through the wind door. This journey has been long anticipated, and we are ready.
Welcome back to Through the Wind Door, where we do part 3 of our discussion of Tiger's Eye, chapters 11 through 15, and we return you to our original conversation, already in progress. Let's talk a little bit more about the actual setup of events as we are mixing up the moments of chapter 12 and Miguel's experience of his adventures in Rama. So, we are introduced to a number of new characters into the story that are brought through as a part of the invading force of Lions. We, of course, have Mohawk, who we picture rightly as being a complete villain, given the way that he is treating the cats that they are taking captive and, taking their stuff as being like, oh yes, I'm admiring their culture by taking their shit and making it mine. And we have the experience of Captain Redcoat, who is, to be clear, she has a very impressive name. She is Captain Beatrix Queensberry. Just like, you know, if you could come up with a more posh name, I'm not sure that one could.
That is a name that you have to say and then do a noise that sounds like James from the Pokemon show and go, "Ooh!"
Yeah, exactly so. And then we have the Doctor character, the one that we tend to have more sympathy for because, first of all, if they're a doctor, then they tend to have more empathy than your average person. I feel like that doesn't necessarily have to go part and parcel with being a doctor. There's been a number of stories over the years, some of which I've even watched and enjoyed, where doctors can be very egotistical and develop a god complex and such like. But in this particular case, the characterization of Dr. She-Ra seems to be the one to be like, okay, I'm working for this organization that is going across the sea and enslaving other cats, and I'm here to do my job to maintain their well-being and health, and I guess, you know, in addition to that, the well-being and health of the rest of the crew. But I've been assigned to do this, and I'm not happy about it, and I'm trying to show as much compassion as I can along the way because I don't necessarily feel good about this. That plays into a later conversation between Dr. She-Ra and the captain that Miguel is privy to but doesn't understand, so we'll swing back around to that. The other thing that happens here, and it's actually quite clever, is that in addition to, okay, so we have a bunch of named characters now, either named by the story or named by their representational features. In the case of the first mate, I don't think we ever actually get his name. He is simply referred to as Mohawk because that's the defining feature that stands out to both Hrau and Miguel. Mm. And even later on, when he is referenced in the conversation between the doctor and the captain, or when the two of them, the doctor and Mohawk themselves, have a conversation, his name is never actually revealed. And I feel like there could be, it may be partly to avoid confusion, to just sort of have everyone on the same page, but by the same token, given how his characterization progresses into the story, I feel like keeping it on a dispersonal level almost makes it easier for us to dislike him, I guess, and he should be disliked. There is some flaw behind this reasoning in hindsight. After all, we also never learn Opalai's true name, even if we do learn the name of his companion, Merrick. And Opalai is one of Frau's biggest allies, as we will talk about during discussion of later chapters. That said, given the way the story goes out of its way to deplatform Mohawk at the end, one can understand why this take didn't come out of nowhere. But yeah, in that conversation at the end of chapter 15, he is only referred to as the first mate. So, yeah. I'm sorry, I actually got away from the point that I was trying to make a second ago. We're introduced to the new characters, but all of a sudden, a lot of the other names and people that were name-checked, even if they were only there for a moment, are part of the captured peoples there. We have Glam and Mar, we have Opalai and his friend, whose name I'm forgetting. I'm sure we'll get back into it as we start talking about some of the stuff that happens on the whale. We find that Shala, the father of Shal, back from Yamaya Village, is there. And of course, Haka himself. So now there's a whole bunch of new characters that we already know in some form that are brought back into the story in order to fill out our ongoing cast of characters. And even as the story keeps on going and we meet new people along the way, or in some cases we actually find out what their actual names are, it helps give us a grounding in everything that's happened before by having this, once more, this economy of characters that give us investment into what is going on above and beyond just Hrau and Miguel themselves. I just very like the way that that sort of seamlessly blended in there. For goodness sake, at one point, I think it's mentioned in passing during chapter 12, but it becomes more relevant later on. One of the captured peoples is the hunting partner of the leopard that Hrau killed all the way back in chapter 1. So that's an ongoing thing that will be a source of tension and drama and the like. This character being Lisseth, who will get her own section next time once she gets a moment to tell some of her story. It all comes together very intently. As we're having that entire experience in chapter 12, and Hrau herself is becoming acclimated to this new sequence of events that she, for all of her powers, she is not able to pull herself free of. This is what leads neatly into Miguel's story, because Miguel has apparently disappeared from the picture, and we don't necessarily know why.
That's a great cliffhanger habit, and a way of transitioning the story from Hrau's point of view to Miguel is just the last, where in Rama is Miguel? And it's just like, well, and then we just shift to him. It's a great transition.
We've already talked about a number of the important aspects of those chapters that address Miguel's situation in terms of everything that happened to him before, the events leading up to him coming through Rama, and of course, some of that direct sequence of events happens as a part of these chapters, where we see, from Miguel's point of view, Hrau fish him out of the river and feed him that first time and protect him from a local predator and such like. And their first interaction is he is trying to communicate with her and give his name in order to associate himself as being a thinking, rational being. There is some intriguing stuff going on in Miguel's own mind, the way he acclimates to what is going on. When he is describing his ability to sort of appreciate that Hrau herself is a person, just, you know, a big cat person. Miguel's touchstone in this instance is based around the theatrical aspects of Mexican wrestling, called Lucha Libre. That is the lens he uses to understand Hrau and the other great cats, specifically calling her El Tigre, the Mexican word for tiger. This actually makes a great deal of sense, since in the world of New Century, the Lucha Libre came into being earlier than it did in our modern history, as a way for the Latin cultures to understand the Wendigo. The word they use is the Nahual, which is something relevant to them, in much the way the British used Barghest, or Americans used Goblin for a while. And this is a further indication of how even though Miguel comes across as very Americanized, he still uses certain words of import that are native to the culture he comes from. So when he's trying to reach out to Corral, it is with the idea that this is just a person in a fearsome tiger costume that he is going to interact with. And, you know, and there is a language barrier, but, you know, there can be a language barrier between two people that just don't speak their language. It doesn't even have to be alien or difference of species even. So he is really putting a lot into using his own imagination and using all of the skills that he has developed, rightly or wrongly, from his father to adapt to the situation. And it works out exceptionally well. As chapter 14 ends and chapter 15 begins, where we start bouncing around in time a little bit, the exact sequence of events from everything that we've seen so far from Perao's point of view with Miguel, that entire area is not recovered only from Miguel's point of view, as we have previously established in some of our earlier conversation. But some critical points, such as Miguel being able to pinpoint, oh, this cat, whose name he doesn't know, but who we know is Junta, is Hrau's father. And he is also able to correctly gender Hrau, even though just looking at her, we wouldn't necessarily, like, unless we were extremely nosy or, you know, familiar with, say, cat anatomy, which, or even cat
telltale signs of patterning or anything like that, which Miguel, he wouldn't have. He hasn't encountered tigers, and it doesn't sound like he's had the opportunity to read up all of this, and goodness knows where he would find a book on this, but no, back to you.
Well, no, so we don't necessarily know everything that he does know. We do know that, again, as mentioned before, that he is associating Hrau with the totem of the tiger, the representation of the tiger, which wouldn't necessarily have, like, somebody else's rendition of it wouldn't necessarily say, like, oh, okay, so if I'm being a tiger wrestler here, but I'm a woman wrestler for whatever reason, then I would want to make sure that my costume accurately reflects how a female tiger would look as opposed to a male tiger. No, that much thought probably wouldn't actually go into the costuming. On top of that, when Miguel names Hrau during their first altercation, he uses the term El Tigre, which is a coded masculine term, since Spanish is one of those inherently gendered languages. To put on the nerd hat for a moment, one could associate this as relevant due to the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, which theorizes that people's thoughts are relative to the language they use to think of those thoughts. I don't actually know how linguistic relativity works to people that grow up bilingual, of course. But based on the current paradigm, linguists say that language only influences thought instead of determining it, meaning that gendered language can be overridden by other influences. The important thing here, of course, is that Miguel did manage to intuit that Hrau is female. And that could simply be a narrative conceit, since the author might want to avoid the problematic feel of assuming that Hrau is male due to patriarchal society. But however he comes by it, it endears us to Miguel more.
I think it shows that just as we have seen Hrau paying close attention to Miguel and trying to get the size of him, Miguel is also assessing Hrau and trying to understand her better. It's not just a one-way relationship of assessment. For the sake of pacing, we have to skim through his side of the process, but details like this show that he is sharp and he has been continuously growing closer to Hrau, that he can intuit these things. Mm. And also, it probably just kind of makes sense to me that the people that he feels closer to or more warmth towards in his own family were the women, at least grandmother and his mother. So, like, it's not necessarily that he is in, I'm not suggesting that he is incapable of ascribing positive qualities to a male parental or guardian figure, because he correctly identifies Hunter as Hrau's father and knows that he is quite a gentle and sort of supportive and nurturing sort, which I think it must be quite a painful thing to see for him, just exactly the sort of father that he could probably use. But I think it does speak to me that this figure that he comes across, who is strong and protective, would be in direct opposition to his father.
That's actually a really great pickup here that I hadn't thought of that. It might just be instinctive on his part, because he associates Hrau with being things that his father is not, that there would be some sort of oppositional identification going on there. That's, okay. I'm going to have to sit with that a little bit, but that may not be far off from the mark. I mean, that could also just be our particular interpretation. I always enjoy these little insights into Miguel's past and how they inform everything going forward in terms of him being able to make sense of the world and make value judgments and generally being the beautiful cinnamon roll that we see in him. I mean, obviously by the time current events shake out with Uncivil Outlaw, he's had a lot of personal growth in terms of the things that he's done and the conversations that he's had with people that, you know, make him out to be different than he is throughout this particular story. But it's hard. It's really hard not to like Miguel. He really is just this beautifully decent person without any of the, he's going to have hang-ups, but he doesn't let them affect his ability to make good decisions. He generally manages that, even if he doesn't always completely understand what's going on, either because there is the language barrier or because, you know, there's context that he himself doesn't have access to. He has good intuition.
Yes.
Like that's, and he responds to that intuition, which can be unusual for a male-coded character. So I very much appreciate that.
Absolutely. And I think what's important with him is that for as much as he is this figure of innocence, as just this young character who has managed to be good, this good person in the face of being raised by this just awful person. But what I like is that he isn't just a good boy. He is also he's also prickly in certain areas that make you, that kind of engender you to him, because he does, and this is, it feels unfair to say this towards Miguel, because I don't want to suggest that he is taking on certain aspects of his father, but when he is going to the Natchez, the two friends that are with him show a lot more sort of uncertainty and kind of want to head back, and he kind of goads them along and is saying, that's okay, like, I'll go ahead, you guys can be chickens. And that's a good-natured young person thing to do, but it's also perhaps a little bit like what Francisco would do in order to kind of get people to go along with what he wants to do. And again, that's a very unfair thing to say. So I will say that that is the only moment where that thought ever comes into my head of, oh, that's actually a bit like what Francisco does.
Looking back on this comment, I think that it might be a little harsh to suggest that this behavior is specifically Francisco's influence. if only because we've kind of established that Miguel sees his father as a template of what not to do. Having read a few chapters now of the first book in the His Dark Materials series, the thing that does come to mind is some of the early characterization of the protagonist Lyra Belacqua. That doesn't make the behavior less problematic, of course. But given how much I know the author loves this particular character, I suspect it's something she grows out of. And therefore, characterizing Miguel with it might merely be a reflection on the author's preferred media, and the fact that even good kids can do problematic things.
These other places where that prickly personality comes up is when he finally feels relatively safe around Harao after she's shown that she will fight a creature and not let Miguel be eaten by it. He walks up and suddenly just kind of goes, you know what? Fuck this. This is insane. What is going on? Like, he suddenly has like a fit. Like, he is just like letting everything wash over him. And he's not just this innocent figure that learns how to act. From the very beginning shows, no, this is too much. No, screw this.
Well, it makes me reflect back on, as you say, the experiences prior to going through the portal, and then the experiences when he's interacting with Harao the first time, and then skipping forward past all of the other stuff, or a bunch of the other stuff, rather, that we've already seen. It's almost like Harao's presence, even if they aren't necessarily able to talk in as fine detail as they might have been able to if there wasn't a language barrier, that she is a good influence on him. She brings a lot of the good stuff in him back up to the surface. He therefore responds to a lot of that as if he is that best part of himself. Like, he doesn't understand the subtext of what is going on when he fails to successfully bring down the Ibex by himself, and he views Harao's distance from him is because of his failure, rather than understanding what's going on inside Harao's head, that she feels that she asked too much of him, or that she gets on top of herself for intervening when he should have figured out how to take care of it himself. And of course there's that whole experience where she's cursing out the spirit of the goat for being so difficult to kill, but he naturally blames himself rather than having a negative opinion of Harao, because he feels like he failed her, and that's part of what leads him to creating the armlet that he does in a hope to bring her back around to him. So seeing the two sides of that, the frustration that Harao has with the choices that she has made previously to help out Miguel, and then being gifted this thing and feeling bad for the thoughts that she had as a result of being given this freely of accord, and then seeing Miguel's side of it, where he's doing it because he feels like he did something wrong. He failed Rao, and he wants to get her respect or get her approval back, or just make up for whatever he feels. He's drawing an interpretation from what happened that doesn't necessarily have any basis in what actually happened. And that could be true whether or not there wasn't a language barrier or not. So it's all sort of very significant there.
And I'm realizing two things from Miguel's perspective here is that first, him failing the game, practice is frustrating because Miguel has this history of being tasked by parental figure to, here's something we're going to do, and we'll treat it as a game. In the sense that it's an exercise, but it's actually framed as necessary for survival. So Miguel has always treated practice as very important, not just to gain the respect of the parental figure who's assigning it to him, but also because he understands that this is part and parcel of their survival. So when he fails it, that is, he realizes the full significance on both parts. But also something that I'm realizing about the language barrier between Miguel and Hrao is that for as much as it is this kind of beautiful commentary on the nature of language and how people can communicate and form bonds even when language does get in the way, I am also realizing something else, a different layer to how it frames their relationship, is that it's kind of symbolic of how when you're a young child, there are elements of your parents that you don't understand. Even if you speak the same language, there will be moments where they will be frustrated or doing things that you can't quite comprehend because you're not privy to everything and you don't have that frame of reference. So when Hrao is frustrated and Miguel senses that there is something more which he can't necessarily pin down, that is very much like that. And his gesture is so reminiscent of what a child does for their parent. They don't know what is wrong, but they want to do something that will kind of go beyond words, that just is shows a level of support or love that they will hope mends what they can't possibly grasp yet.
Yeah. That
Miguel's a good boy, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. He is a good boy, and once more, as a result of the midpoint of chapter 15, we see another of those decisive moments for him. Just like standing up to his father, he could run off, and I don't necessarily know that he would successfully get through the wind door on his own had he left Hrao to fend for herself, but he makes the choice to stand up for Hrao, even as he worries about, you know, is he just going to screw things up further like he did with the Ibex? Just feeling as young as he is and uncertain, but he still turns around and uses the tools that he has available to him to get in there and punch the poisoned bone claws into Haka's side in order to assist.
It is so clear to me now which roads I can take. Ahead lies the waterfall. I can almost hear the rushing sound as the river crashes down in the distance. There is the doorway back to America. I may survive the trip from here to there with what I have learned. Then I shall return to the riverboat, walk back to Memphis, explain my absence to my father, and spend the next month trying to make it up to him. That is, if he is still in the city. This misgiving has come back to me time and again since I arrived in the jungle. What if he moves on without me? Would he wait? Would he search for me? Or I could pull the bone knives Hrao made for me, free of the fastenings on the belt I fashioned. I could go back there and lend what little strength and intimidation I can muster to protect her from this brujo. I can be the mongoose. But what if I make things far worse? The city is peaceful, aside from the growling behind me, echoing down the alleyway as Hrao and our pursuer engage harsh words in their language. I am just a little boy. A little boy who is going back to save his friend.
One might almost be curious about if that actually made a difference. It might have, because we do know that the very next thing that happens when we see those events in Chapter 11 is that both Haka and her have been brought down by trank darts used by the Lions of Albion. So it's already interesting there that Haka would have had to fend off both the non-native soporific poison from the dart gun, but also the stuff that was tipped on Miguel's bone knives there. And it might very well account for his later inability to use his complete facilities or even some of his powers, because we already know that as a shaman, he has magic available to him that could be helpful to that particular situation. But at the end of the day, the effect of his decision is not as important as what it means to Miguel and what it means to Hrau that he came back for her. He may or may not have saved her life, but the significance is that he tried.
Mm-hmm.
And then Miguel has to think on his feet again as he realizes what's going on and has to process it very quickly, and comes up with the rather clever idea, due to the natural difference between species and height and all that kind of thing. He avoids being treated the same as Haka and Hrau by suddenly imitating a pet, by imitating a monkey, which obviously it lends itself very well to the circumstances given our natural similar genetic heritage with apes and such like. It may well be that he picked that because of the essential, like, we don't necessarily associate monkeys as being particularly dangerous. We associate them as being more comical. And in this particular case, the cats perhaps have a similar frame of reference. Like, I know that if you actually look at some of this stuff in the wild, that certain breeds of that phylum or family, or I don't have the right words to describe it, but monkeys and apes can definitely be violent with each other. I think chimpanzees can be exceptionally violent, but we have a narrative conceit of having them be more trickster types and, you know, thieves and scoundrels rather than as aggressive opponents or anything like that. So he uses the closest analogy that he has in order to assure that they don't try to kill him or try to put him in with anybody else.
It's a mitigating tactic. It's yeah, like, exactly. Well, this is a difficult situation. How can I kind of not let them know, like, everything about me, mm-hmm. and also ensure that my method of capture maybe means that they underestimate me?
Yeah, which it honestly wouldn't take all that much under the circumstances. This is where the character of Captain Queensberry starts to flourish, because it's her that steps forward and takes possession of Miguel, putting him in a perfect location for where we can view some of the following events. Having Miguel present in the captain's quarters is actually narratively important in order for information to be conveyed to the audience that the protagonists do not know. In many movies, the idea of audience-exclusive knowledge is common, as the movie can always cut away to another room to show people talking. And this can even happen in public, if there is a language barrier, such as like what happens in Chapter 12. She-Ra and Mohawk are talking, and Hrau does not understand their words. But because of how this story is constructed, having a separate scene would be jarring, because all of the story takes place from the perspective of whoever is narrating. Even if they cannot understand what is being said, one of them still has to be present for the scene to work. And aside from that, even if he cannot understand the words, Miguel still learns something from the exchange anyway, as he uses his experience with the cats to understand things like body language and speaking tone and the like. But regardless, these exclusive conversations help keep us engaged with characters that are important to the story, both in terms of plot and development, which is why the audience gets to understand what is being said. So yeah, as Chapter 15 comes to a close, we are now given more information in addition to what we got from Chapter 12 and the interactions between Dr. She-Ra and Mohawk, and getting more of a sense of how things are playing out, even as Miguel is doing his best to continue to keep up this illusion. Like, I'm just a pet. I'm just a playful monkey, and you can put me in a cage, but you should take care of me and feed me because I'm fun to have around. You know, just like, oh, look at the little doggy.
One extra detail about that I think makes it work, and it's also quite shrewd on Miguel's part, is he can safely bet that these cats will be familiar with the concept of monkeys because he has actually encountered monkeys in this world. Yeah. So, like, you know, if he hadn't done that, it would be like, wait, do they actually have monkeys in this world? Will they, like, sort of recognize what kind of behavior I'm going for? Or will they be like, what the hell is this doing? Okay, no, this is weird, kill it. And also, the fact that he, when they find him, he will be in clothes, so they had to recognize that he's been dressed to some extent. Might be that, you know, maybe these lions are aware that the wild monkeys can be dangerous, but, you know, when you see, in our culture, when you see a monkey wearing clothes, it's the sort of thing that you go, okay, well, that's quite silly. Monkeys don't wear clothes. How ludicrous. This will make a fine pet.
I mean, look at it this way. We dress up our dogs and our cats in clothes all the time. So it's not like it's, like, I don't know what the over-under of that was in regards to, like, ancient times or anything like that. That's more of a modern conceit, particularly now that we have cameras and we can post them on the internet and everything like that. And I know that in a couple of occasions, there is an author that I follow on Twitter whose cat, they are very long hair. They get very thickly shaggy and everything like that. But they have a nervous thing where they are, like, I think perpetually cleaning themselves or getting, like, hairballs or something like that, to the extent of it's actually dangerous to them. And so therefore, in that particular case, what they end up doing is that when the pelt gets to a certain length, they basically shave the cat pretty nude. But because that leaves the cat pretty cold, they specifically put clothes on him so that he is warmer, and obviously now he doesn't have his own fur to start kneading at or gnawing at or anything like that, and it's just safer and more comfortable for the cat in general. Like, that's one of the few occasions where dressing a cat in human clothes is actually for the best of the cat, rather than some kind of, you know, like, adorable but potentially, like, problematic behavior of, you know, using your cat or using your pet as a prop for that kind of thing. But it is obviously clear that in that particular case that there are times when, you know, little booties or clothes of various kinds can have a purpose other than just selfish or, oh, isn't this cute motivations for wearing these kind of things. That particular aspect of it isn't necessarily important from a narrative standpoint, but, you know, in addition to acting more like a monkey, he puts points that out inside the story himself, that he is drawing upon his experience of monkeys to play act this performance. He is trying to seem like he is endearing, and so therefore is kind of like, say, a golden retriever or something like that, that just likes people in general as long as they don't try to hurt him and doesn't necessarily have the proper fear response to, oh no, you've hurt my master or something like that. However that works out, Beatrix decides to claim Miguel for herself, and that puts him in the position where we get a chance to see more of Dr. Shira and Redcoat and learn more about how this world is developing its own slave trade and the significance of how they are in the situation that they are, how we learn more about both of their opinions going forward here, which is... I mean, we've covered a little bit. Yeah, exactly. We've covered a little bit of this when we were talking with Loretta about why she enjoyed playing Captain Beatrix and the things that she was bringing to the table. But if you just read the narrative on its surface of how the captain is choosing to account herself and the very real crime against felinity that they are perpetrating by framing it in these cold, calculating terms. What's the phrase that everyone likes to use? It's not personal. It's business.
It's you not personal.
Okay. We need a little bit of humor to get through this moment here. But yeah.
I feel like Beatrix would approve of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, yeah. I want the brushy.
It's an important conversation to have because as much as Beatrix is utterly reprehensible for her participation in this, it does provide a certain amount of, like, it puts into clarity where her lines are, or like how, where they may be.
It's going to be even more put into sharp focus later on in the story as well. But this is the beginning of her characterization.
Yes.
And we see the two of them not quite butting heads, but, you know, the doctor asking questions and listening intently to the captain's responses. As the doctor herself tries to get a sense of how the captain is able to be involved with this kind of thing and yet have such a seeming lack of compassion for the cats that she is perpetrating this on. And it doesn't necessarily become clear that the captain has any feelings about this one way or another, because she is, like, when she's talking with the doctor, she's saying, like, this is the terminology you want to use. This is how you should think about this so that you can do your job in a proper fashion and not let your emotions get in the way of what we're doing here. And yet, you know, as we just alluded to and as we will talk about next time, the captain does have her own limits that this act is butting up against. Like, yes. Captain is telling herself her own story that allows her to do her job and profit off of this horrible, horrible bit of business. So it's like as if she is trying to be a bit of a mentor figure to the doctor in terms of, like, look, this is the situation we're in. I want you to be at your best so that you can help me protect all of us, but really more so that we can protect our profit line at the end of things. The picture being painted here of the captain as a person is not getting off to a great start, which may make new readers wonder why we're putting such focus on it. And all I can say for now is that this author always loves complicated antagonists over simple ones, and that Beatrix is going to have many opportunities to add layers to her character. Some for the good, and some not so good.
What we have seen with the three kind of named or established lion characters are three different responses to this slave trade that the lions have established. You have...
Oh, you God.
Have, yeah?
Oh, God, I hadn't even thought of that. I do know that it's usually Jungian stuff that Sharon likes to bring up in relation to the psychology of whatever movies that she sees or whatever fictional property that she talks about. But let's think about that for a second. Yes. We may actually have to continue this later on. We may actually have to continue talking about Chapter 15 later on because we are coming up against a hard time here again.
I will just finish this thought and then we shall wrap it up. But
Okay. I'll finish my thought. Which is that what if the captain, the doctor, and Mohawk are, to a certain extent, representations of ego, superego, and id? Does that follow? Because
yes, it does.
One could definitely see the uncontrolled id in a lot of what Mohawk does, and one could see the coldly logical perspective of the ego in the personality that Beatrix is playing. Meanwhile, the Doctor has the benefit of being the superego, which is often referred to as the conscience in that trio of psychological concepts.
Yes, because what I was going to say is that what you have, the three responses you are seeing, is Dr. Shearer's measure of compassion or just questioning that if this really has to be as like excessive as it is. And then you have the practical response, which is Beatrix, which, and this differs from Mohawk because Beatrix is not interested in inflicting pain on these creatures for the sake of inflicting pain. It is we need to enforce structure, and like no matter what the cost is there, but that, and we see that in order for her to preserve structure, she's not bending the structure to inflict pain, because when the option comes for packing them more tightly, she says, no, it's better to pack them less tightly. And that's not out of necessarily, for the time being, a compassion for them. It's the structure works best if we go this way, because otherwise things, they die, we get less stock over. So that's...
The stock, that's the term that keeps coming up in reference to all this.
Yeah. That's her viewpoint. That's her philosophy, is that she has to think of it as stock, and that they're just trying to work out the best way to shift the stock around. And then you have Mohawk, and he doesn't really appear to give much of a shit about the business. He is kind of opposite. He is very interested in inflicting pain to inflict pain, to push these cats in his captivity. And that is, I think, the three different responses we're seeing here. I think we will have our first talking point of the next session with the id, and all of that. So we will leave that tantalizing line there for us to pick up next time.
Well, yeah, one of the things we're definitely going to end up talking about, if both the captain and Mohawk are components. You should keep doing that. Come on. We're trying to come to a close here. If there is a difference from the way Beatrix and Mohawk are approaching what is a very real injustice, then both of their motivations are selfish. But in the case of the captain, Beatrix would seem to be merely participating in an evil that would exist with or without her, and she is just choosing to partake because of the profit and status it provides her. Mohawk, on the other hand, would seem to be someone with no moral values at all, and therefore has taken his job because it provides him the opportunity to not only profit, but also the freedom to visit violence and suffering on others. It's this kind of mentality that one sees most often in the toxic soldier or police officer, and most frequency in a corrections facility guard. Captain Hadley in The Shawshank Redemption and Percy Wetmore in The Green Mile immediately come to mind as examples of this. But how this darkness in Mohawk shows itself is a conversation for next time.
Listeners, we hope this has been as engaging and entertaining for you as it clearly has been for us, given our propensity to talk on and on about these things. But for now, we will leave you.
Next time, the chapters we will cover are 16 through 20 in the written version, but 16 through 21 in the audio drama.
That will be our next trip through the wind door.
Take care.
As it turns out, with all the editing, the runtime for parts B and C of this combined episode ended up to be only about 1 hour 15 minutes. There will be some outtakes, but less than usual. But as Ollie referenced a week ago, the raw discussion of the next 5 to 6 chapters is over 5 hours long. So we'll see how many episodes that actually boils down to over the course of January. In addition, we'll have our interview with Spencer Lieb interspersed between our Tiger's Eye recap and the final overview episode. So the cat content will continue likely through March, and our one-year anniversary as measured by our first Skype recording date. It's been a hell of a ride, folks. I hope you and yours have managed to have good seasonal holidays, and that 2021 ends up better for us all. Now would be a great time to play us out with Hazy Shade of Winter, but I already used that song many months ago. I pondered going back to some more world music that would be appropriate to the Tiger's Eye setting, but in the early hours of December 26th, as I finish this edit, it makes more sense to play something appropriate to the season. Not Christmas specifically, but rather something reflective of the final twilight of the year. Sarah Bareilles was an artist I fell into unexpectedly. I find, the older I get, the more I prefer the music of women over men, as they offer the poetry and emotional honesty that I crave in my music. Let's hope that we can also break the chains she sings about in her own life, as we toss this old year into the dumpster and start fresh. Until next time, this is December.
Settled long and heady on my shoulders. The winter's light feels different on my skin. It doesn't seem to strike as far below the surface, so I have to conclude that shadow won't let it in. Shadow won't let it in. Shadow. December.
Enough of the preamble. Let's get to the main event.
All right.
That's a very good preamble.
Nothing is wasted. I've been trying to make sure that everything is mined for content.
We use all of the audio cow.
Oh, that's going to be a great one. Thank you. And when we move on to chapter 13, that same guitar is heard after Nalix? Nalix, the nega version of Alex. And this is me fucking up pronouncing Winona Ryder's name for the third time. Winona Ryder. Bleh. Of how
it's Winona a hard name Ryder, to say.
It is a hard name to say. A good discussion
Winona
of how
Ryder. As we were talking, I was thinking, this is such good stuff. We are not finishing this in one episode.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this isn't like, say, The Imposters, where Miguel is able to understand what's being said because the subtitles are showing up in the real world and he's able to read them. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Imposters, but that was a hilarious fourth wall breaking moment there. We've had another long, intense conversation that itself has gone on for 2 hours now. And I know some of that is still pre-conversation, but holy shit.
We're going to have to split part one into two parts and part two into two parts, aren't we?
I don't know. I mean, we'll see how...
we'll make it work.
We'll see how this all ends up when we finally get to the editing process of this. But at this point, even though we are discussing the same five chapters in two separate recordings, I'm almost pondering, just considering this recording to be not episode 17B, but like episode 18 in its own right. Like that's how deep we've gotten into the conversation here.
It's like a sigh, we can't help ourselves.
Yeah, okay. And it's not like all of a sudden we've taken Alex's assertion that, oh yes, you're doing a sumptuous macaron here. It's like, oh yeah? Okay, we're just going to dump a whole bunch of stuff on you here. Enjoy all of it. We're getting to the point where we're going on.
So, you like donuts, eh? Well, eat all the donuts in the world.
And this is just me at the end of the second Skype conversation, marveling at just how long we had gone on these subjects. Holy shit.
That should be the way you close up now.
Yeah, exactly.